Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a sunny and very pleasant day. This is your host, John Gresham, bringing you this week's edition of Military Monday on Blog Talk Radio on the RightStream Network. And today we are going to have a talk about a very special kind of warrior in American history, and for that matter, in the history of warfare around the world. And this is the role of what we call the scholar soldier. What we mean by that is that this is someone who, in addition to wearing the uniform, who goes and serves regularly in field operations, also has a strong academic background, usually a graduate level education, and uses that education as an advisor, as a policymaker, and as an interface between the military and the rest of the world. In our time, we would think of someone like General Dave Petraeus and General Colin Powell fitting this mold. But long before they were here, there was another one, and he's probably unknown to most of you. His name is General Andrew Goodpaster. Those of us who had the pleasure of knowing him, and I did slightly, called him Andy. He was a kind and gentle man who had a vast influence on U.S. Cold War policy and was the primary military advisor to President Dwight David Eisenhower from the time he was commander of NATO until he left office in 1961. We are lucky enough today to have U.S. Naval Institute Press author Robert S. Jordan, who has written a number of biographies of generals and other interesting people over the years. And he is the author of An Unsung Soldier, which has been released this fall by U.S. Naval Institute Press. And let's see if we got you. Robert, are you there, sir?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you for coming on Military Monday. We do appreciate it. And let's go ahead and get your take on this idea of the soldier scholar. Where does this individual or the kind of individual fit in the pantheon of leadership in our military? And what is their inherent value to politicians who actually make military policy and decisions?
Well, it happened that when General Goodpaster was a cadet at West Point, 1936 to 1939, his mentor there was a man named George A. Lincoln. He called himself Abe. He was a captain at that time and head of the Department of Social Sciences. And Abe Lincoln was the first career-serving Army officer who obtained a Rhodes Scholarship. He got that in 1929. He was the first to go to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. And he became persuaded that a career military man, Navy, whatever, had to understand a little bit about history and social science in order to be an effective serving officer. And this was new, very new. In those days, the way to the top was engineer. You went and you became an engineer guy, and then that didn't require you to know a lot about what they taught at Oxford. And he believed that very strongly. And now, Goodpaster was his brightest student. He was too old for a Rhodes Scholarship, but he had the kind of intellectual capacities that Lincoln really understood and wanted the career Army officer to possess. One of the ways that he demonstrated that was he nominated Goodpaster to go to a Council on Foreign Relations college student competition, and this is the first time that West Point had ever been involved in it. These were the Ivy League kind of people. And Goodpaster had been a very effective debater even before he became a student at West Point. And those debating talents served him well at this conference because he came out as the, I guess what you might call the winner, and brought some attention, serious attention to West Point as an academic place. And throughout Goodpaster's career, Lincoln reappears over and over again. So we have to link George A. or Abe Lincoln and Rhodes Scholarships with the kind of career that Goodpaster had.
Now, you say that this was the first time that a Army officer, or for that matter, any military officer, had really gone and emphasized this kind of academic work. What had changed in the world that made him believe that it was necessary for officers to know more than writing, shooting, engineering, surveying, the traditional course of study at West Point, as a good example? What made General Lincoln feel that this was going to become a necessary skill set for future Army officers?
Well, I think he was in the minority in the 20s when he went there, but I think it partly was the after effects of World War One, where the force of nationalism, for example, led to a very self-destructive war. Nobody really won that war, and he felt that the military simply couldn't sit back and say and salute smartly, as they say, and go in there and slaughter a generation of young men without understanding the significance of all that. And I think General Pershing understood that. So the culture of the Army changed, was changing. It hadn't changed, but it was changing as World War II approached. And World War II was not going to be the U.S. coming in at the end. World War II, if it was going to be fought, if the U.S. was going to fight it at all, they understood it was going to be a really big war, and they've got to go beyond simply winning the battlefield.
Now, obviously, he was Andrew Goodpaster was not the only individual like this who must have been touched by General Lincoln. Who else would you characterize from that period of the late 1930s as having been influenced by General Lincoln's academic thoughts and ideas?
Well, there were a number of younger officers who were had the same kind of background, similar. A lot of that had to do with their academic performance at West Point. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but then later on, when Goodpaster became the first serving Army officer who was assigned full-time to Princeton to do graduate work, initially, and this was George Lincoln again, he was in the Pentagon at that time, and the Army wouldn't send him there unless he did engineering. Lincoln knew in his own mind that while he was at Princeton, he had to study the social sciences, but he was running against the current even at that time, and this was the late 1940s. There were three officers. One went to Yale, one went to Harvard, and one went to Princeton. The Harvard man didn't stay after he got out. He got out of the Army and didn't stay in. The Yale man stayed in, but he didn't reach the same level of prominence that Goodpaster did, partly because Goodpaster was associated with Eisenhower so for so long. And this again, as I say, his mentor, his sponsor, was Lincoln. And after Goodpaster had finished the master's program there in engineering, the faculty wanted him to stay on because he was obviously a very able student. And so Lincoln had to get permission. He had to talk his superiors in the Pentagon into allowing Goodpaster to stay on and do a PhD, which was partly technical, which the Army would understand, and partly sociological, which the Army wouldn't have necessarily understood. And a doctorate by a serving Army officer was unheard of. And Goodpaster was the first to accomplish this. So when you introduced him as a soldier scholar, he was it on two levels here, one as a cadet and Rhodes scholarships, and then later on he was a PhD at Princeton, which paved the way. And then you mentioned General Petraeus. He has a PhD from Princeton.
Yes, he does. I was noticing some rather strong parallels there, obviously. And for those of you who may be interested in asking questions of myself or Mr. Jordan, please feel free to call in. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, area code 347-945-7246. And before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about your interest. What actually drove you to being interested in General Goodpaster as a subject for a book? I know you've done a number of other biographies of senior military officers, including Lewis Norstead. Talk a little bit about what drew you to Andy Goodpaster as a subject.
Well, I did a doctorate at Oxford and one at Princeton myself on the origins of NATO. And anybody who studies the origins of NATO has to know something about General Lord Ismay, who the American public wouldn't have heard of, who served Churchill in the same kind of role during the war that Goodpaster did Eisenhower. In other words, he was that man at his side who had the complete confidence of the prime minister and would do those things that were not exactly in that chain of command. And so I learned about that, before I had ever heard of Goodpaster. I learned about how these kinds of people serve the great man, but history doesn't remember them very well. And so when somebody asked me to do a book on Goodpaster, by then I knew him. In fact, I had awarded him an honor at Princeton when I was president of the Graduate Alumni Association. What he did for Eisenhower, I understood immediately by having done my dissertation at Oxford on Lord Ismay. So it was an easy thing for me to accept. My professional reputation presumably led these people to want me to do this book. But I have to say that it's not an obvious book in the sense that there wasn't a great war that the Cold War never achieved the level of popularity, you might say, that World War II did, and the generals who were instrumental in keeping the Cold War cold largely faded from history once they finished their careers. And you know a few of those yourself. And the The group that wanted me to do this felt that good pastor needed to be remembered, that he had this kind of unique professional life, but also in a personal kind of form of leadership that the Army only came to just before and after World War II. And so it was something that I found very gratifying to do.
Now, you and I have both had the pleasure of meeting General Goodpaster before he passed away. My impression of him was of an absolutely charming, patrician, intellectual, very, very kind and gentle human being. You know, these kinds of things come at you from Andy Goodpaster. But he had some other qualities, not the least of which he could command. And in fact, he did command a unit during World War II, did he not?
Yeah, well, you've raised kind of two issues that are parallel, and some people might say contradictory. That is, he really, his real goal as a professional Army officer was to be a commander of troops. And at the same time, just because of who he was, as we've outlined here, he also was very good at more policy making, I guess you'd call it, which doesn't lead to great distinction. He was involved in the planning of the Vietnam War. Nobody would have heard of him in that context because these men were in the Pentagon there. I mean, how many people know who planned the Iraqi War or who planned the Afghan War? You know, who were the ones in the Pentagon who actually planned the war and developed the strategy? These people go unknown. General Petraeus gets a lot of credit with this, but behind General Petraeus, there were an awful lot of very talented officers who, you know, argued for what they thought was the appropriate way to conduct a war. And Goodpaster fell into this category, even though he wanted to be a commander of troops. And as you mentioned, in the Italian campaign in World War II, he achieved distinction in the battlefield, and he was wounded and given awards for that, and went back to Washington. And he was going to be mustered out of the Army for medical reasons. But General Lincoln happened to find out he was there, and he grabbed him and pulled him into a planning unit that was both Eisenhower and General Marshall. He has to come into this here, too. They felt very strongly by the 40s, after the war, that the Army should have a group of thinkers who could project forward and anticipate problems and not just wait for the problems to pop up. And Goodpaster became part of that little cadre of career Army officers. Now, these are privileged men in the sense that they were relieved of all other duties, but also, as I mentioned, they're not that kind of a role is very appealing to us today. It's almost commonplace, and you've got all these think tanks around Washington who are doing it. None of that existed during those days. The Brookings Institution was the only one around. It was, again, I think, far-sighted on the part of Eisenhower and Marshall and Lincoln to set these people up and create a career opportunity that hadn't existed before. Thinking ahead, anticipating where the U.S. would be, who the enemies would be, how you deal with them politically and diplomatically as well as militarily. And Goodpaster distinguished himself in that role in the late 40s, again, as almost one of the forerunners of what came later.
Now, at some point during the late 40s, and this has been an amazing 10 years roughly since General Lincoln was teaching at West Point, had discovered Good Pastor, and I assume a few others, and yet just a decade later, Good Pastor is being thrown into the role of helping advise the senior leadership that's going to create NATO, the basic command and military structure for the West that's going to fight the next 45 years of the Cold War. How well does this young, still relatively young officer do in advising General Eisenhower and the other senior military leaders who are trying to make NATO work in the late 1940s?
Well, General Alfred Gruenther gets some of the credit for this, which, again, nobody has heard of today, but was very important in his time. He was on the in the Pentagon, in the JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when Eisenhower was tagged by Truman to go over to NATO to set up the military side, the civilian side was already in existence with Lord Ismay there. And after the Korean War broke out, then the U.S. became very anxious and that perhaps the Korean War was a feint for the Russians to make a frontal attack in Europe. And so they, as I say, they drafted General Eisenhower to come back in uniform and go. And this was under a lot of time pressure. And so they, General Gruenther, who became Eisenhower's chief of staff in NATO, had to assemble a group of officers almost overnight, it was a matter of days, to arrive in Paris, where the, it was going to be set up then, in the Palais de Chaillot in Paris, to be the advance group to get just to set up the headquarters, not even to do anything more than that before Eisenhower showed up. Now, you can imagine the pressure. Here is the four-star general, the hero of the European War, and he's going to be over there in 2 weeks, and we better have a headquarters here for him. And so you could just imagine the pressure on this. And so Gruenther, he got the best talent he could find in, under those circumstances.
That 2 weeks, something of a Chinese fire drill for all those staff officers.
Absolutely. And they Good Pastor in that. Actually, Good Pastor signed the order that created the headquarters. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody else couldn't have signed it as well. But what it meant was that he drafted it, and so therefore he signed it. And that you can see how central he was then to the creation of the military side of NATO. And it was, although he had, and Eisenhower had crossed paths earlier when Eisenhower was chief of staff of the army, this is the point where Eisenhower really took, became aware of Good Pastor in a more personal sense, so he could, then when he went to, won the election, he knew about Good Pastor and wanted him. I think you can really attribute the association that evolved during the presidency to the creation of NATO. And there again, you see, Good Pastor is at the right place to do something that hadn't been done before. I mean, there was that time that, as a cadet, there was that time later on when he became the very much of he was the first to always be there at the time when the opportunity arose. And this is another example of that, that led to a further career opportunity, one of the best any serving officer could have had. He was only a lieutenant colonel at the time.
Now, what was the dynamic of the relationship between Goodpaster and Eisenhower during Ike's final military tour as NATO commander? How would you describe their relationship evolving, developing, and what was it when Ike left to retire and eventually move on to political life?
Well, you had to have his job in NATO wasn't really to be a military commander, but to be a military diplomat. He spent a lot of time traveling to the member states to persuade not the governments that it was important, but the people who were very frightened of anything that would trigger off another war. They'd just gone through this horrible war. And so his persuasiveness was what, and that gregarious smile that he had, you know, the reputation he had for being invincible after the war. And Goodpaster's job, the headquarters job, was, in other words, not necessarily to have a military command as a military command, but rather as a policy body who could interact with other member governments. And one of the things that Eisenhower wanted was that his headquarters would be truly multinational, and every national military organization hates that sort of thing because they want their own chain of command. They want to control where they go, what they do, how they're funded, and all the rest. And Eisenhower said that NATO would not succeed unless the headquarters gives the example of multinational command, and that meant that the smallest member nation had to have their officers there along with the big boys. And this really is something that it runs counter to traditional alliances, military alliances. You remember that in World War One, the U.S. would not subordinate its military to the Anglo-French command, although on paper it would have been more efficient to do that. Well, that's not untypical. So the thing is that Goodpaster was involved in creating a multinational headquarters. He had to set an example of getting along with officers from other of the member nations. And as I say, this is other than the coalition of World War II in Europe. The U.S. military really hadn't had much experience in this sort of thing. And again, this kind of uniquely trained and educated officer was at the right place at the right time with the right set of talents. And so although the Americans had the last word, I wouldn't claim that it was otherwise, and certainly in the European command side, the American Army was firmly under the control of the Pentagon, but within the a coalition environment and relating to the political arm of NATO, which is another thing, it took an officer that had a much broader outlook upon his role than simply being a commander of troops. And these officers were just then rising through the ranks. By that time, he was a lieutenant colonel. Today, it's obvious, but it wasn't obvious in those days, and Eisenhower gets a good bit of the credit for that.
Now, in 1953, Eisenhower is inaugurated president, and one of the people who becomes really kind of a ubiquitous presence in the working West Wing of the White House is Andrew Goodpaster. Talk about how he was asked to do this and what was his role to be over those next 8 years in the Eisenhower White House?
Well, he wasn't the first choice for Eisenhower. The first choice, unfortunately, he was a brigadier general. He died shortly after he took the office. He had a heart attack. In those days, middle-aged men died of their heart attacks. Today, they survive them, but they didn't in those days a lot frequently. And so, good pastor. He didn't come to the White House right at the beginning. The chief of staff, Robert Cutler, had met Good Pastor, and he didn't know him, but he had met him. And the reason he met him is because Good Pastor's name already was being circulated in those circles. As somebody that Eisenhower wanted to find a place for. And so when this job opened up, Eisenhower wanted him and asked for him by name, and he got him by name, and he came in there as a newly created position of defense liaison officer to the CIA and to the Army, and staff secretary. A staff secretary job is a military type of job. It was unfamiliar in the political hierarchy of the West, of the bureaucracy of the White House. But Eisenhower felt that there wasn't somebody in there who could organize effectively. Eisenhower was very sensitive to the use of his time. I guess as a military man, he could, you know, make it clear that what he wanted and what he didn't want, and he got it. In a political environment, it doesn't work quite that way. It's not quite as clean as that way. I'm sure that President Obama, whatever his daily calendar is, it gets interrupted constantly. Eisenhower, being a very methodical man by nature, was annoyed with this sort of thing. This isn't something that he had had to contend with in his career. He hadn't been president of Columbia long enough to get it through that job. And so he created the position of staff secretary, and which in a military context means that that person screens all of the papers and people before they get to the boss, and they try to screen out everything possible except what they know the boss really wants to see. Now, a politician can't afford to do that in the same way, but Eisenhower wanted it that way. And so, but he wanted somebody in the job who was tactful, who didn't make enemies. And one of the points about Good Pastor is that throughout his career, even though he had an obviously privileged career, I'm sure other officers could have envied, he didn't make enemies.
As our mutual experience has proven, this is a guy people off the street meet and they want to be friends with him. They like him. He's a nice guy, and he's likable.
Well, he was likable, but he wasn't a man who curried favor. He didn't. That isn't the way he became likable. He was likable because of his personality. He was slightly distant. He wasn't a glad-hander type at all. He smiled, but it wasn't one of those ingratiating smiles. But what he said was honest and trustworthy. And I think one of the reasons I think he didn't make enemies in a highly political environment that he was in professionally for so long, before he went to the White House and after, is because they could trust what he said. And Eisenhower wanted that because he was so close to Eisenhower in the day-to-day work of the president that he understood what he could say that was honest, but not too revealing, in the sense that Eisenhower didn't want to The idea of leaking to the press was not quite as popular then as it is now. And the sense of trust, I think, is one of the traits of good pastor that we have to really remember him for. Not so much being a friendly, outgoing fellow, but a man who could be trusted and had a personality that didn't grate on people. He wasn't one who, you were never annoyed after you had dealt with him.
And to those who think, oh, it was the 1950s, it must have been a joyous time to be in the White House, let's not forget that when the Eisenhower administration came in, we were still deep in the depths of the McCarthy era. I mean, there was a genuine political tension in this country that people like Eisenhower and Good Pastor had to work around. Plus, of course, the fact that the Cold War was a going proposition. Joseph Stalin was still the dictator of the Soviet Union at the time, correct?
Yeah, he died earlier in Eisenhower's administration. The job that the chief of staff, the hierarchy of those who were more political, who had the political influence in the Eisenhower administration, of course, John Foster Dulles was the big man in that administration. Good Pastor didn't, because of being the staff secretary of war role and defense liaison officer, he was a step or two down, and so he wasn't involved in the more political side of foreign policy. What he did do, he managed to not offend his army colleagues because in the Eisenhower administration, you may recall, Eisenhower wanted to reduce the budgets of the army and increase significantly the budgets that had to do with nuclear weapons. And General Ridgway, the hero of Korea, became chief of staff, and there was a great deal of tension between Ridgway and Eisenhower over this issue. The Army said, well, he was one of us. You know, he won the wartime coalition, he was chief of staff of the Army, et cetera. And now what does he want to do? He wants to ruin us. And Good Pastor managed to stay on good terms with his colleagues, including General Ridgway, over in the Pentagon while he was working for Eisenhower. Now, that shows a good bit of diplomacy and personality that, you know, that he knew he was going to go back to the Army after that job. So, you know, you better be pretty careful what you do. And he did it with and maintained his integrity, which is quite good, quite noteworthy.
And the result was the New Look strategy, which was for most of the 50s and the early 60s, the American strategy of the day, which, as you just said, Good Pastor clearly was one of the major craftsmen of. That said, let's talk about another one of the things that he is associated with regarding his time with the Eisenhower administration, and that is the creation of the remote sensing infrastructure that is the backbone of American intelligence gathering today. Explain real quickly Good Pastor's role in formulating what became the U-2 program and Operation Overflight into the Soviet Union.
Well, let me start by saying that his doctoral dissertation at Princeton was on technology and national security. In other words, he had combined the two in the late 40s, which again was unusual for military officers. He had that engineering background. And he, as you say, he was very interested in the whole business of aerial intelligence, I guess you might call it. A lot of that was secret, of course, and the what people might not realize is that Eisenhower had to be persuaded. Although he wanted overflights, the intelligence was extremely valuable. He was never comfortable with that, partly because, as he commented once, he says, if the Soviet Union were doing to us what we would do to them, I think I'd probably go to war. And so he understood that although it was valuable, it was also very dangerous. And Goodpaster understood that very well, partly from his own background. So it wasn't a case of where Eisenhower just was fascinated with all this new technology and wanted to use it without realizing the dangers. And, of course, when the U-2 thing blew up in his face, it ruined his presidency. So although it was important, and it certainly served a valuable purpose in either validating or invalidating what the Soviets were up to, it also turned out to be a disaster for him. And Goodpaster would not have necessarily influenced the policy one way or the other, but he certainly understood what was going on, and he was the liaison with the CIA, so he was right in the middle of it all.
As we start talking about Goodpaster and the things he was doing in the White House, it's important to remember that, as you were pointing out earlier, Goodpaster was all about cordial and positive relations with the other people, including the president. Obviously, beginning in the mid-50s, the president had some significant health problems, including several heart attacks. You were talking about that earlier. How did Goodpaster help relieve Eisenhower of the burdens of responsibility during his recovery from those attacks? And what did this do to their relationship as it went on into the late 1950s?
Well, Eisenhower is the first president who actually was sick a good bit of the time on his second, starting with his campaign for the second term of office, actually. Anything like that involves the president shakes up the pecking order in a hurry. And in this case, the Dulles stepped in to take charge, although in a legal sense, the vice president would probably have been seen that way. But Nixon was not a central figure in the Eisenhower administration. And so one of the things that Goodpaster had to do was to jockey around between the vice president and the secretary of state, making sure that Nixon was involved enough so that he couldn't complain of not being involved. But in fact, Dulles was calling the shots. And Goodpaster was, most of the time during the illnesses, was at the hospital, either living nearby, like in Denver, when Eisenhower was there for quite a long period of time, or when he was at his Gettysburg farm. Goodpaster would be there, would go up there a couple of times a week at least, to make sure that the control over the paperwork was even more disciplined than it was when Eisenhower was healthy. And in that sense, behind the scenes, he played a very important role, a very powerful role, because what the president sees and who decides it, along with on paper and along with people, that person is extremely powerful. And during the illnesses, Goodpaster played a very important role in that respect.
And it's important to remember again that this was before the 25th Amendment was passed. That would come, of course, after the assassination of John Kennedy. But he was doing a lot of the functions of balancing the various players in the Eisenhower administration and keeping things on an even keel, correct?
Very much so. Again, I think because of his personality, and most people around the president, look around the president, are very powerful. They're men who enjoy power, obviously, and they want to be seen to enjoy power. And here was this man who actually had a good bit of power, who chose not to stay in the background and resisted the whole idea of being singled out in that way. One of the geniuses of the pastor, and I say this partly because I'm sure he did it as a conscious thing, but also just by the nature of his personality, he did not thrust himself forward. He would not be the first to engage in a chat, in a conversation, for example, if it wasn't relevant. If somebody would engage him, he would respond. But the thing is that he was not out looking for friends. He was more inclined to wait and find out what they're like before he got himself involved with them. It's a kind of a personality trait, again, that instills trust, because you realize instinctively this man isn't going to take advantage of you. As I say, around the White House, that's a wonderful attribute to have. When Eisenhower was sick, it became even more so, because a good bit of the policy, day-to-day policy making, had to fall on other people. And then they had to rearrange what their roles were. And good pastor sitting at the center was able to keep everybody happy in a sense where he didn't play the power game himself, so he could be the guy who got everybody else to cooperate with one another under very stressful circumstances. It'd be easy to point out other examples of where that didn't work that way.
Now, come 1961, Eisenhower retires, the Kennedy administration arrives. What happens to Andrew Goodpaster, who obviously has been promoted somewhat, is now a general? What does he do during the Kennedy years, and more importantly, what does he do when John Kennedy is assassinated and Lyndon Johnson comes into office?
Well, Kennedy pretty well ignored Eisenhower's structure. They brought with them their own ideas of how to run the White House. And so, in a sense, there was never a replacement for Goodpaster. Goodpaster later commented that he felt that was a major mistake, because some of the policy issues and the way they were being decided in the Kennedy years created problems of their own, which, in Goodpaster's opinion, could have been avoided if he'd had the same kind of similar setup to what Eisenhower had. In other words, don't be impulsive and screen who you talk to and wait a while before you make a decision that you might regret. When Johnson came into office, he saw Goodpaster was then, as you say, a general. He was working in the Pentagon, and Johnson saw him as a conduit to Eisenhower. He wanted to keep Eisenhower informed as to what he was doing. He had two other objectives. He wanted to recruit Eisenhower in support of the Vietnam War, which Johnson was escalating and becoming more a matter of political discussion, and a lot of people were opposing what Johnson was doing, and the civil rights movement also was giving him a hard time. So he saw Eisenhower as a kind of a validator of what Johnson was doing with his prestige, and so he used Goodpaster as a liaison to Ike and kept him very fully informed as to what he was doing. And Eisenhower, his attitude, of course, toward Vietnam was stay out of it. And he did that himself when the French were defeated and they wanted the Americans to intervene, Eisenhower wouldn't intervene. But his attitude was, well, if we've got ourselves into this mess, then we've got to stay in it and do it and complete it and do it right. And so he had, it was a conditional support from Eisenhower, but one that Johnson badly needed for his own political reasons. And then later on, if I can jump ahead a little bit, when the good pastor was deputy commander in Vietnam, he felt that the war was not lost on the battlefield, but lost in Washington. So good pastor had the conventional military explanation for that war, that if the politicians had stayed out of it and left us to do the job, we would have succeeded.
Now, the coming of Richard Nixon as president, who was not an individual unknown to good pastor, resulted in what can only be described as a dream job for someone like good pastor. He got to become supreme commander for NATO and for U.S. forces as well. I mean, this must have been an amazing capstone to an incredible career at this point.
Well, he certainly was flattered to get it, but he really wanted to be chief of staff of the Army, which is more important to, that's the number one job. And then in those days, the Supreme Allied Commander was in some way more important because nuclear war was on the table in those days in a way that it isn't today. He didn't get the chief of staff's job, partly because they had to figure out what to do with Westmoreland. As Supreme Allied Commander, one of the biggest jobs that he felt he had was persuading the alliance and the American people. And this is different from when Eisenhower was the first Supreme Allied Commander. He had to persuade the American people we should remain committed in NATO because we were drawing down our European forces to fight the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So he had a double challenge that Eisenhower didn't have. He had to keep the Allies building up their forces while the Americans were reducing their forces in NATO. And this is a big persuasion job that only the Supreme Allied Commander can do. That required a good deal of traveling and public speaking. And he was a good public speaking speaker. He wasn't an emotional kind of speaker, but he was an informative public speaker. And again, that element of trust came into play. Because the Americans were not all that popular in Europe by then. The Europeans as a whole disapproved of what the Americans were doing in Vietnam. But he himself, as the Supreme Allied Commander, maintained his integrity, and he was listened to seriously. And that was a big plus for him.
Go ahead.
Well, could I also? I think we're getting close to the end, and were going to take me here, but I need to comment on the fact that he returned to active duty and became superintendent of West Point during a time when West Point was going through a big cheating scandal. And as we know, the academies tend to periodically get themselves involved in scandals. And this is kind of, I think, the summation of what he was as a professional Army officer and then later on as a public servant, was that when the cheating scandal emerged, and it was in the engineering department, they had trouble even finding out how many people were involved. It was a big deal. They turned to good pastor in retirement as a four-star general because of his reputation of integrity. I mean, nobody would question that General Goodpaster was not the appropriate man to deal with this. And the superintendent's job was a 3-star position, and Goodpaster was 4 stars, and they offered to get an act of Congress passed that would authorize him. That would be a personal piece of legislation to authorize the superintendency to be a 4-star. And he declined that. He said, no, that would be the worst thing I could do, to go to West Point as the example of ethical conduct and then have a privilege thing handed to me. And so he went there as a lieutenant general, and that's just an example of his sensitivity to this whole idea of trust and an example that a serving Army officer should show. And I don't want to go into detail, but he did clean it up, and then he retired, and he retired with a great deal of honor attached to him.
And during that final retirement, the years that you and I got to know him, he became this amazing scholar and a historic icon and touchstone for those of us who were trying to get a handle on what had happened during the Cold War. Here was this living, breathing time capsule of history, just walking around. All the neurons were firing, and if we had a question, he would answer it. Talk a little bit about that important academic and scholarly function that he performed in his later years.
Yeah, he moved easily among the think tank world. He was at the Atlantic Council for a long time and chairman of it. He had two major things that I think he should be noted for. One was, he believed very firmly in disarmament, and a lot of people remember the New Look in the Eisenhower years as a matter of building up atomic and nuclear weapons at the expense of conventional weaponry and strategy. And they tend to overlook the fact that the other side of that, the complementary dimension of that, is disarmament. And he was very much involved in the think tank world in the 80s and 90s that promoted disarmament as a form of enhancing national security, not the other way around. And to some extent, he was arguing against conventional wisdom. And the other thing he took from the Eisenhower years, and Eisenhower believed in it, a lot of people don't remember this about him, is that he set up the United States Information Agency. Not as a propaganda thing, the CIA was doing the propaganda, but rather to demonstrate that within this democracy called the United States, that political persuasion is preferable over the use of force. And if we just look around the world today, we can see how the use of force is so much more popular. And during his retirement years, he would continue to make the case that weapons only have a limited utility and they should be a last resort. And there should be every effort made to resolve conflicts peacefully, or at least minimally violent, not maximally violent. And you see how that works in regard to the whole idea of nuclear war. And so he felt very strongly on both of these counts.
I want to thank you for coming on and helping introduce to people who've never known this man to just an amazing, amazing human being, and which is really reflected in the title of your book, An Unsung Soldier. I know, of course, you've done a number of biographies of senior military personnel. What are you working on now? What's the next thing you're going to publish?
Well, I don't know that I ever publish it or do it. I'd like to do General Alfred Grunther, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff. He also, during World War II, was General Montgomery's chief of staff. He became the Supreme Allied Commander in NATO in the 50s, and then he retired and became president of the American Red Cross. And most military generals who retire, either in those days went to work for a corporation, like General Norstad did, or they play golf. But they don't necessarily get involved in peacemaking stuff. And he did. And then the other thing about him was he was a world-class bridge player, and Eisenhower loves to play bridge. And Grunther, in 1930, when he was a junior officer, wrote a manual on contract bridge, which is still used today. And in other words, if you look at these three things about him, he had an unusual mind and an unusual personality. I think he's worth having a book. Whether or not one will ever be written about him, and whether anybody wants to, you know, sponsor it, I have no idea. I'm trying to raise some money for that purpose, but it's not easy because these generals fade from view, especially since the Cold War.
I understand and appreciate your challenge as a writer myself. Sir, I want to thank you for coming on today, sharing your memories and your stories of General Goodpaster. I hope we have you on again, and thank you for joining us. We did appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And good day, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
And with that, we've come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. Next week, we're going to have a really good time. Our friend Eric Wertheim, also a Naval Institute Press author, is going to come on and talk about the mammoth publishing undertaking of the new edition of Combat Fleets of the World. This is a massive reference book. You could almost sell it by the pound. It's that heavy. But it's also become very rapidly, over the past couple of decades, the standard work for those of us who need a reference book on every combat vessel, submarine, aircraft, and gun. So come on and join us next week at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll have Eric to tell you how he did it. And with that, have a great week ahead, and join us again for the next edition of Military Monday. Thank you.